government shutdown. Why has it dragged on? And on the other hand, how much does it really matter? Also, shutdown or no shutdown, President Trump's tariffs are about to go before the Supreme Court. And in the meantime, the president keeps adjusting them pretty much every week. He also seems to be taking some liberties in bombing accused drug boats off the coast of Venezuela. We'll tackle these issues and more on this episode of Independent Outlook. Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from Independent Institute in Oakland, California, where we try and provide an independent take on the issues of the day. For today's discussion, I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Philip Magnus, who holds our David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy. Great to have you, Phil.
Happy to be here.
I'm also joined by my colleague, Dr. Williamson Evers, Director of our Center for Educational Excellence. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
Phil, let me start with you. Last month, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives passed what they called a clean bill. But since the Republicans don't have 60 senators, the Senate can't pass it unless a couple of handfuls of Democrats vote for the House bill. I think it's been voted on about 14 times in the Senate, maybe since the House offered their so-called clean bill. Always getting majority, but never a majority of 60. So, Phil, what's a clean bill? And how come only two or three Democratic senators will vote for it?
Yeah, so the clean bill, it's actually another way to refer to a continuing resolution that doesn't contain any new addenda or riders or material that's been added. It's basically, let's keep the current trajectory of the 2025 budget, and they want to extend it through, basically it was the end of November. But because of this, the Democrats want more funding on health care, and they are holding firm on that in the Senate and using that 60-vote threshold as their mechanism to try to push the Republicans to the table and essentially approve new additional funding that's not on the House side.
So a clean bill means it's just about the funding. It's not about other subjects. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's no new addenda or riders or pork or pet projects that are added on. It's just continue the current existing levels of funding.
So for one thing, though, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky refuses to vote for it because he says it doesn't have any cuts and it doesn't put in the DOGE proposals. So he is voting with the Democrats on this. Now, when they had a vote on whether to keep paying people who are showing up for work, Senator Paul did vote for that.
So you've got both AOC and Rand Paul both refusing to vote for the so-called clean bill in the Senate. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, but for different reasons. So, you know,
exactly.
One wants cuts, the other wants increases.
Yeah, right, exactly. What really surprised me, though, is I saw that the head of the American Federation of Government Employees, which is the biggest federal workers union, his name is, Everett Kelly, he said very recently, suddenly out of the blue, he said, it's time to pass a clean continuing resolution and end this shutdown today, which suggests to me there's kind of a crack in the Democratic coalition on the subject. What do you think?
I think politically, you know, they're both playing brinksmanship, but they're gauging on whether the public at large blames the Republicans more or the Democrats more. And you have rhetorical jockeying going on that side. The Republicans, I think, do have the upper hand simply because they have the majority in both chambers. But at the same time, you know, the Democrats are trying to find leverage against a president that they've been unable to strike any legislative blows at so far.
So I think there's two additional aspects to this. And one is, what are these Obamacare subsidies that are
exactly
holding this up? And the second is, will the Republicans further gut the filibuster in order to break out of the impasse? I think, Phil, you should explain about these Medicare subsidies.
Ooh.
Briefly.
Briefly, yeah. So I guess it all goes back to the original Obamacare bill, you know, which was passed and was upheld by the Supreme Court, but has never quite been on a sure legislative footing. And there have been elements of it that were basically unfunded and elements of it that ended up costing much more than the original promise.
Isn't it also that during COVID and various other times, they've expanded who is covered by this?
Oh, absolutely. So Medicare, you know, originally it was for impoverished people, basically people with dependents underneath them. So Think of a single mother with children, or a person that is unable to basically pay their basic medical needs. Well, that has been expanded to include working age adults that are merely in the low income stratus that don't have dependents on them. And this puts further strain on the system.
So back in the Senator McConnell days, they had pledges of various people, including a dozen Republican senators, saying, I will never, never, under any circumstances whatsoever, get rid of the 60-vote filibuster. But it certainly looks like that they are reconsidering that.
That's a worry, because it's this continuous erosion that we've seen over the past couple of decades of Senate norms. You know, we saw some elements of it earlier this year when they were trying to mass approve, and they did. They mass confirmed a suite of presidential appointments in ways that had never been done, and it was all to circumvent that there are roadblocks being thrown up by the opposition party. But this goes back to Harry Reid also doing some of the same tricks.
Oh, I remember.
Doing the same tricks.
So it also seems to me that although there are libertarian commentators and some conservative commentators saying, look, the government's running fine with only the quote-unquote essential workers, why don't we get rid of all the other ones? If we actually look at the Republicans' behavior in the legislature, in Congress, they are not talking about cuts.
Right.
The only cuts that are really being suggested are from the Trump administration. And who knows whether those are bargaining chips or real cuts.
So your argument is that the fact that the government is functioning as much as it is, the argument that shows we don't really need the government to do all this stuff isn't really carrying the day. Is that right, Bill?
Unfortunately, yes.
That's a simple
and clear
answer.
There are editorials in the Wall Street Journal, columns in the Wall Street Journal. There is commentary from John Stossel. But these are people that have always wanted a much smaller government. So
I really do think that if the primary union of the federal employees has decided to side with the Republicans on just pass the darn clean bill, that something's going to break before too long. That's my political assessment of the situation. And I guess we'll see. And maybe by the time our friends join us in watching this program, it'll be resolved. I think we should hope so, although I'm never quite sure on these government shutdown things what I should hope for. So let's move on. The next big thing on the nation's political agenda comes next week on November 5th, when the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in the case of Trump's tariffs based upon the invocation of the emergency, so-called emergency provision. So can you briefly summarize for us, Phil, what's going to be talked about on November 5th during those oral arguments?
Yeah. So this is the VOS selections case with a couple others that have been consolidated into it. And listeners may remember we discussed this at length. It was at the appellate level a couple months ago. And the appellate courts basically struck down Trump's claim to have the power to impose unilateral tariffs under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA, which is the piece of legislation from the 1970s. Trump has invented a new tariff power under this that doesn't exist in the legislation, but he claims he infers it from the text. And the Supreme Court is going to be weighing the arguments that came out in the two lower court decisions that went against Trump. And I'd say the big ones that are before him is because the Constitution is pretty clear. It says in Article 1 that tariffs are a legislative power, that the exclusive domain of Congress. They have to be passed by an act of Congress. So the court is going to consider, can Congress give that power up to the executive branch? Can they delegate it? And there's pretty strong case law that says, no, they actually can't at this degree. They have to put intelligible principles or parameters around it, and they have not done so in the way that Trump is using them. So you've got that question underlying it. And then you also have questions about, does the emergency power that he's claiming, do the instances of causes for imposing tariffs rise to the level of an actual emergency? Because Trump has claimed something that is basically unprecedented in U.S. history. He says the existence of trade deficits themselves are an international emergency. Well, we've had trade deficits for basically 50 years, and they haven't been an emergency until 2025. He's also asserted that fentanyl coming from Canada is an international emergency. The number of seizures at the border in Canada is minuscule of illegal fentanyl. And in fact, there's quite a bit of evidence that the U.S. sends more fentanyl the other direction into Canada than actually comes into the United States. So is that an international emergency? And then Trump, you know, we've seen his behavior over the last few weeks has been very erratic on this. He's adding all sorts of new things into this. He's claimed that his dispute with a judge in Brazil is an international emergency and justifies tariffs against the Brazilian government. He has most recently claimed that he doesn't like a TV ad that the government of Ontario, Canada ran, pointing out basically the problems with his tariffs, quoting Ronald Reagan. And he's saying that that also justifies a retaliatory tariff. So he's basically said an emergency is anything and everything Donald Trump wants it to be. And as a result of this, the court is considering, you know, does this meet the word of the statute even?
So I would say something further about the Ontario province ad. Not only did Trump accuse the central Canadian government of being doing it, which is not true. The provincial governor is different and really doesn't see eye to eye with the premier.
He's kind of a loose cannon in Canada.
He is. He's kind of like the Donald Trump of Ontario in some respects.
Right. So not only that, but also Trump claimed, well, it's fake. So it's tape of Ronald Reagan, okay? And yes, they did, you know, change where certain things were, the order of certain things. But and it's also about Japan and Congress not imposing tariffs on Japan. It's not on Canada per se, but it's about the general issue of protectionism. It doesn't misrepresent what he said or his position. And I don't want to claim also that Reagan was 100% free trader. He did impose non-tariff barriers and tariff barriers at various times. But overall, he was much more pro-free trade than Donald Trump. And there's another aspect to this that we don't want to lose sight of, and that is what's called the Major Question Act. So that means that if something is not explicitly conferred by Congress on the president in no uncertain terms, and it has a dramatic, large-scale, massive effect on the economy, it can't be done by the president. He doesn't have authorization to take action on major questions. Now, there's a caveat here, though. So back in June, Justice Kavanaugh said, well, we've never applied this to a foreign policy or national security matter. We've only applied the major questions doctrine in domestic policy areas. So the lower court that the Supreme Court is hearing the decision from cited the same law review article that Kavanaugh cited back in June, pointing out that foreign policy and domestic policy had not been used. So this is, if there's anything, so I think Phil's points about, is it an emergency? Did he actually get authorized? Those are great points. The problem is the history of the U.S. Supreme Court deferring to presidents on national security and foreign policies. I mean, supposedly Korematsu, which is putting the Japanese in concentration camps, has never been formally overruled. I mean, it was written by Hugo Black, a very civil libertarian guy, and he just basically said whatever the president wants to do in foreign policy and with relation and military, he can do it. I don't really think the Constitution says that, but
if Kavanaugh thinks it does,
that's right. If Kavanaugh thinks it does, there's a problem for anti-protectionist, pro-free trade people.
A historical question, maybe, Bill, can remember this. When Ronald Reagan did occasionally resort to supporting
Harley
tariffs.
Helping Harley Davidson.
Yeah. Well, when he did so, did he rely on invoking emergency declarations like IEEPA?
No.
How did he get his tariffs in place?
I think he used the standard things.
Yeah.
He did not use, I'm not saying Ronald Reagan never declared emergencies, but I'm saying he did not use some kind of terrible national security crisis as the basis for doing it.
Yeah, that's the big difference with Trump. So previous presidents have absolutely imposed tariffs, but they do so through a series of clauses in the law.
Right.
You refer to them, that there's a Section 201, Section 301. These are supposedly discriminatory practices
right.
from abroad.
And there's also tariffs for a certain time period. When Trump is claiming to do it, he can do it indefinitely into the future. Not to speak of adding 10% one day and taking 10% off the next
right.
day.
Well,
I mean, this is not what the statutes pertaining to tariffs.
Then there's the very basic way when the president then persuades a majority in Congress that a tariff is needed and they enact it by legislation and he signs the bill.
That's
there's the 60 votes problem.
Yes.
Well, yep. So he knows he can't win on this. I don't think he could even get a majority for some of the bills that he would want on a tariff.
Right. Right.
There are enough Republican defectors.
I agree with Phil. There are secret non-vocal not against tariff people among the Republicans.
Okay, so one little subpoint for Phil, I want to just go back to something we talked about once before. Let's assume that the majority of the court is not convinced that IEEPA is properly invoked by President Trump. And that would imply that these tariffs, at least in the case affected, would have been invalid from the get-go, which implies that the government might have to repay a whole bunch of money, not to foreign governments, but to American importers who were penalized with the tax of a tariff. Is there any way for the court to rule against Trump on this claim of IEEPA emergency, but not force them to pay back all that money?
Right. And that is the potential carve-out they could take, because there are clauses of U.S. law that allow temporary tariffs for up to 150 days.
It's been more than 150 days.
It has been. So we crossed that barrier in August. It's conceivable that the court takes a backdoor out of this by basically giving him a mulligan and saying, you can't do this any further
right.
in the future, but we're going to allow you to
pretty hard pretty hard to apply some kind of legal reasoning to
well,
that.
Well, they could say it was a good faith misinterpretation.
Right.
I know.
On the other hand, the government has already admitted in its legal filings that, yes, the remedy is to return the money.
Yikes.
Well, they're trying to put the squeeze on the Supreme Court, saying
absolutely.
You are, holding up the government to an unbelievable bill. And it would be very embarrassing to the president, who has boasted about all this money flowing into the treasury. It all has to flow back out.
This is
Meanwhile,
why
he spent plenty of it.
Yeah. The court should have never granted a stay to
That's
the original
right.
ruling.
Phil is
they
exactly
should have paused
right.
it right there.
That's right.
They made their own bed.
It needed to be decided way early and not way late.
So in the meanwhile, the president has traveled to Asia, and among other things, he's trying to readjust tariff issues in relation to China and Japan. And the funny thing is, in the wake of the advertisement from Rob Ford of the province of Ontario showing Ronald Reagan's old speech, Prime Minister of Canada, Carney, went off to Asia as well. He went to, I believe, Malaysia, among other places, trying to get some trade advantages for Canada in this strange situation. Apparently, though, President Trump is meeting or has been meeting with Premier Xi, and there may, in fact, be some ratcheting back down again. Is that true? What can we make of that?
Well, my sense on the trade agreements, the so-called agreements that Trump keeps saying that he's, I'll paraphrase John Nance Garner, they aren't worth a bucket of warm spit. These are not so gentlemanly agreements between Trump acting as the head of state and other heads of state, but none of them meet the legal statutory requirement of an actual trade agreement. Congress has decades of laws spelling this out. There's all sorts of legislative oversight on it. They had something that was called trade promotion authority that would basically require Congress to give an up and down vote on what was negotiated. Trump has taken absolutely nothing.
Which was meant to expedite.
Meant to expedite, yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And especially expedite lowering of tariffs and non-tariff barriers so that Congress couldn't, you know, get into the details of it. They would have to vote on what the executive branch negotiated.
And this is considered a valid delegation of power. So it's back to the Supreme Court issue, the legal issue before them. Congress laid out all sorts of terms on how to make trade agreements. Trump has ignored those and come to these agreements that I guess they exist in his head and maybe on some scrap notes somewhere. But at the end of the day, they're unenforceable. If they all come down to him just issuing executive orders under IEPA, there's just no basis in law to bind the United States or any of the other trade powers to this. And I think foreign countries know this, so they're waiting on the decision just like we are.
Oh, yeah, they've got to be.
I think the most fun part of this whole quasi-war with China is to hear the Chinese communist leaders talking like Richard Cobden and John Bright in favor of free trade and peace. Peace through international commerce, and this is not that they really believe that in the ideological heart of
theirs,
but they've adopted the rhetoric. Exactly.
As has Elizabeth Warren
for talking about the more socialistic home. She did have her libertarian period when she was associated with Henry Manning long ago, a forgotten episode in classical liberal history.
Let's change the subject, although it's still going to be Trump. So President Trump has apparently decided that we are in some kind of state of belligerency with Venezuela, or is he just intercepting drug runners? I'm confused.
Well, first of all, almost no fentanyl comes from Venezuela or Colombia.
Just like Canada.
That's right. Exactly like Canada.
It's almost exclusively Mexico.
So what happens is the drug smugglers and so forth, they import the components of fentanyl from China largely, and then they have factories in Mexico. They make the fentanyl there. Fentanyl really only came on the scene because of various crackdowns of the United States.
Other drugs.
Yeah, and because fentanyl is very... A tiny amount is immensely powerful.
It's a vicious drug.
Yes, but it wouldn't even exist if it hadn't been for U.S. drug policy. Anyway, I digress. The point is that Venezuela is not smuggling, and Venezuelan drug smugglers are not smuggling. They might be smuggling cocaine, a multitude of other drugs.
Conventional drugs.
But also, the people that they're blowing up are in the sort of Venezuela, Trinidad area. They could be fishermen. The Colombian president has insisted, including naming the guy, that one of the people who was destroyed, killed, was a Colombian fisherman, and that he was having distress problems, and he had a distress light on, and they just blew him up. Normally, the Coast Guard would catch somebody closer to the American shores.
But this was not close to the American.
You're off the coast of South America.
Exactly.
Hundreds of miles away from anything.
Okay, so then secondly, we don't need an armada. We don't need a flotilla that looks designed.
Aircraft carrier group.
Right, the Gerald Ford aircraft carrier group is off the shore to try to trigger an internal rebellion or a collapse of the Maduro government or maybe ground things. So Trump has been saying land. Again, with Trump, you know, he's a blusterer, he's a bluffer, he's trying his poker tricks or his brinkmanship tricks or whatever. And we don't really know what he's planning to do, but they're supposedly according to news articles, they're training to take over airports and ports and other things that would be very serious. And to have a military expeditionary force in Venezuela would make some of these Middle Eastern wars look like picnics, because the jungle is very serious there. And it's not obvious that the Maduro people would just surrender and lay down their arms.
But millions of people who voted for Trump thought that they were voting for a guy who was against these forever wars and against nation building with
it's
the U.S.
funny
military.
The New York Times today had an article on the Vice President J.D. Vance, and how he talked about not getting in entanglements and not getting into unauthorized wars, and how he, you know, balked at some of the missile attacks. This is early on the famous Signal thing where they let...
thought he was good on this stuff.
The problem is, of course, it's like Bush Sr. as the vice president for Reagan. If you're the vice president, you're having to climb on board the locomotive of the president. You really aren't an independent political creature. But this could, if Vance runs for president, this may come back to bite him, because he's on record saying things earlier that are the opposite of what he's saying now. I think, and he's not, there are many Republicans that would like to have a more narrowly defined America First foreign policy, and they're not happy. There's a string of newspaper articles detailing some of this. So we have this thing. We might be at war with Venezuela. We might be at war with Colombia. They might certainly be undeclared wars. The president has said in interviews that he's not planning to get a congressional authorization for any of this.
So it's just like the tariffs.
Right. Well, as Senator Paul said, the Constitution does not give the president the right to blow up foreign-owned ships to smithereens.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if they're attacking the U.S. coast, that's one thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So
but this is
another thing, and
hundreds of miles away.
He's claiming we're in a state of armed conflict.
That's a careful formulation.
Well, it's his formulation. It's not a law.
Conflict.
and certainly neither the Colombian nor Venezuelan government has declared war on us or has its troops.
United States brought arms to a conflict, therefore is an armed conflict, is basically the legal standard.
Right. So, you know, in terms of the journalists that have investigated whether fentanyl is being smuggled in boats out of either Colombia or Venezuela, they aren't finding it. So in terms of the factual predicate, it's not there.
Has the CIA been authorized to undertake covert action inside Venezuela?
Yes, it has, and the Maduro government claims that they have captured
CIA assets.
They describe them as CIA mercenaries or private contractors or something like that. At least in my reading, I haven't read the details of this, but I did read the detail of what the Venezuelan government said.
And Maduro's been claiming that basically since the beginning of his dictatorship, as did Hugo Chavez before that. Anytime they arrested a political prisoner, they charged them as being a spy or a CIA asset. Now, whether that's true or not.
Okay, fair point. But I think it's possible that in the current situation, I don't know. We don't know enough, but it's sounding a little different this time, that they might indeed be armed combatants or
something
commandos
like,
or something like that.
Yeah. And that, unfortunately, it plays right into the rhetoric of Maduro and these post-colonial theory Marxists that claim that the United States is this bad actor trying to seize the oil and take over the developing world.
Right. In fact, there's something that's been featured, and that is some statement of Trump's in the background, some years ago, saying, well, we should take over the Venezuelan oil.
Right. So he's giving them all the propaganda that Maduro needs to bolster up his failing regime.
And what's really ironic about all this is that if he stood back and gave the rhetoric of freedom and liberation and not the arms and the bombs, the Venezuelan regime has been moving toward collapse of its own accord.
Oh, absolutely.
And now this will prevent that trajectory, which seems a shame.
I say, give the Venezuelan oil back to the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey.
You mentioned, Bill, a little bit ago, that Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky said that the president just doesn't have the authority he's claiming to exercise in Venezuela. Rand Paul is pretty much a thorn in the side of President Trump. He recently has criticized the taking of stakes in private companies by the so-called U.S. government sovereign, whatever it's called, sovereign wealth fund, if there is such a... How can a country that's $38 trillion in debt have a sovereign wealth fund?
Right. Usually it's an oil-rich country where they have, you know, cash flowing out of everything, and so they don't know what to do with it, so they set up these investment funds. We are not in that position, but what he's trying to do is in these deals with foreign countries, he's saying, oh, please put a few billion in our sovereign wealth fund. And they're doing it, or they're saying they're going to do it. A lot of these supposed deals, a lot of these so-called deals are promises that probably will never happen. But go ahead,
exactly.
Phil, please, you're trying to make an important point here.
It's going back to the Supreme Court decision. If the tariff power goes away, all of these deals basically evaporate.
Well, we're talking about deals, foreign deals, but there's also domestic deals. Where U.S. is taking 10% stake in Intel Corporation. Is that right?
Yeah. And there's a TikTok thing. There's all sorts of. There's metal companies that he's doing stuff in.
And these companies are welcoming it. Like, bring on
the federal
dollars.
Rents to disperse. There's taxpayer money.
They're hoping to get subsidies without interference. I hate to say this. It sounds like a Robert Taft Sr. era Republican slogan, not a present day one, but federal money means federal control.
Yeah. So when American capitalists who run these corporations and so forth start taking in government money and putting it on their balance sheet and so forth, is that an exercise in capitalism? Capitalists are doing it. Is that capitalism? Phil, you're smiling at me.
I think it's very much the opposite. I mean, if you want to play fast and loose and redefine the terms, to say capitalism is everything Trump wants, but that's just a flip side to the left that says capitalism is everything I dislike about the economy.
Well, I mean, but also more specifically or precisely even, capitalism can't be whatever somebody who looks like a capitalist happens to do. Because what if somebody has been a successful capitalist but then decides to turn his back on the principles on which his own wealth was originally established?
Are you talking about Arm & Hammer again?
Oh.
It's not just the ones we mentioned. It's also quantum computing that the federal government is getting into.
Well, I would dare say it's a form of socialism. It's a form of economic planning.
Or mercantilism or something. Yeah. It's certainly not laissez-faire capitalism. It's certainly not classical liberal capitalism. I started to say fascism. It is maybe also close to fascism.
Yeah.
It's like crony
socialism with a nationalistic flair.
Yeah, right, exactly. Oh, nationalistic socialism, that has ringing historical bells.
It unfortunately does.
And so crony capitalism isn't really capitalism, I think, is the point that you guys are making. It's kind of a repudiation, actually, of capitalism when you turn to state power to get advantage in the marketplace that you couldn't otherwise secure. Short of coercion that you're not allowed to do privately. But the government can use coercion. And if you can get the government to use it to your advantage, that's great, it serves your self-interest, but it's not really capitalism, even if you look like a capitalist. It's something else. Like the TikTok thing. Like you were telling me about the TikTok thing. How is the TikTok solution a form of crony capitalism, Bill?
Well, so the key thing with TikTok is the algorithm. And so, you know, you could formally sell this, that, and the other, but what's powerful is the algorithm, which takes the past behavior of the customer and puts in front of the customer the things that he or she has looked at in the past in possibly a more exciting form, which is the complaint about it. Anyway, so the question is, can they get the algorithm? So it looks like, we don't have it finalized yet, but it looks like they're going to get the algorithm. But the Trump people have said, well, and Trump himself has said, well, we should get something for doing this. So we'll see. I think this visit to China, we're talking in advance of the final completion of whatever the deal is, but this might be when this is finalized.
Is there any chance, speaking of the visit to China and the talks with Xi, do you think it's possible that Trump's erratic behavior and threats and whatnot could actually induce the Chinese government and Communist Party, as it were, to take a freer stance?
That's possible. They had a phase. Well, I mean, in a sense, you sort of have a formerly socialist state that's now kind of an authoritarian mercantilist state. And you have a more liberal economy in the United States that's getting more and more mercantilist. So, you know, mercantilists can make deals with each other. We might get some good things. Jimmy Lai might get the Hong Kong publisher who's been in jail for 5 years might get freed.
Free Jimmy Lai, I say.
So you never know what's going to happen. It's just, one of the things about the Middle East peace and the Gaza ceasefire is that it was negotiated by kind of mercantilist big business types and not normal diplomats. It's very hard to predict what this kind of thing is going to amount to. And, the Chinese have their goals. Trump has deep goals and sort of shifting tactical goals as well as strategic goals. So we'll have to see. Obviously, what we'd really like to see is free trade, both directions. Certainly, we can import everything without tariff and non-tariff barriers, and that would help our consumers and our businesses. But right now, the rhetorical climate doesn't lean that way, and the president's longstanding pro-protectionist beliefs don't stand that way, except at the time when he talks zero for zero, which is, I guess, when Steve Moore is in the room.
I am going to change the subject in a moment to Bill's bailiwick education. But before I do, is there any topic you'd like to throw into this mix briefly, Phil? Or comment?
I just say, to continue on the theme of China, is we have to remember that the Chinese economy is not in the best shape itself. The Xi government is not as strong as it projects externally. There are internal turmoils there. I kind of liken it to, you know, how the Soviet Union was in the 1960s and 70s. Their external propaganda was, oh, they're going to overtake the United States. But internally, they have their own problems. And that's what gives me some hope that maybe them coming to the negotiating table, they also recognize that, there are benefits to them if they liberalize in certain areas.
So we kind of tend to think of China in terms of, what are they strategically trying to do with the United States? But the key thing to think about really in China is what Phil's getting at, their internal political problems. What are the incentives that Chinese leaders face in terms of keeping the population under control and them in power. And, you know, they just had a gigantic purge of their military. I mean, just an unbelievably large top-level purge of the, and people who had been close to Xi. It's not like these are some kind of parallel sidebar group of people. So
the purge of their statistical agencies that do all the economic work. I mean, you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
The economic cover-up, whatever.
Exactly. I mean, it's child's play in the United States, all the controversies over the BLS. Compare that to what the Chinese government does with its own economic statistical reporting. People disappear overnight if they don't meet the GDP target.
All right. Well, don't give anybody in any other countries any ideas for talking about this. I do want to say, Graham said that we're going to get into the education area, and I agree. And by the way, one of these things that has to do with buying companies or state companies in the United States has to do with mayoral candidate Donnie. He wants to have not just free buses and stuff like that, but he wants to have grocery stores, which is would be a government enterprise. So that's... election is in the offing, and we'll have to see what that's going to be in the polling data. He's quite a bit in the lead, double digit in the lead. Mm-hmm.
And against there is a very defective candidate, yes, or opponent.
Yeah, his independent slash, you know, the former governor Cuomo is plenty flawed, particularly for his COVID policies, but also...
personal sexual ethics, all sorts of
sexually mishandling people and whatever. So, in a sense, the socialist candidate has an ideal opponent, but it's not ideal for the city of New York. And we may have state action in the economy in some catastrophic big way in New York City. I began by saying Phil also knows all about education and higher education and has written books on the subject, so he's going to share with me talking about this compact idea.
Well, he may, although I recognize Phil may need to drop off for another engagement.
Right,
thank you for spending this time with us, Phil Magnus. I'm
absolutely.
So grateful
happy
for
to be
that.
Here.
So Bill and I are going to talk a little bit about higher ed.
All right.
So Bill, I will
catch you later.
Catch you later. Thanks again, Phil.
Both Graham and I have suffered in worlds of higher ed.
Exactly. So Bill, what do you think about this compact that's been offered to American universities by the Trump administration? It seems to me that the things that they want to induce the universities to do are probably things the universities ought to be doing. But then I wonder, is it really the place of the federal power to induce them to do so?
Well, it's clearly a mixed bag. Now, so there's many things that you and I wish the universities would do, particularly the high-powered prestige universities, the Ivies, the University of California system, Stanford, Caltech, MIT. If these universities would be better and live up to their potential, it would be better for their students, their professors, and the world. Some of them are drifting a bit in the right direction on their own and not necessarily under pressure from the federal government, but also just people getting fed up with some of their crazy DEI proposals and propaganda and overburdening bureaucracy and all these things. So some of this is addressed. I mean, some of it's bizarre. You can't raise your tuition. Well, that's price fixing.
Yeah, you know, how can you not raise your tuition?
There's all sorts of strange things in there. Rich Vedder, who's associated for a long time with Independent Institute, we've published his books. He's an expert on the economics of higher education. He points out that there are plenty of things in here that are good, but they're not really the federal prerogative. Now, it seems to me that I'm not saying I would do this, and I haven't reflected enough on this to think of the problems, but it seems to me if you're giving money as the federal government to universities to do research or to support programs of inquiry of some sort, you can I think, have a restriction on it that it, we're only giving you this money if you have academic freedom in the university.
That seems entirely appropriate.
I mean, you know, if avenues of research or of, you know, controversial questions can't be discussed on campus, it seems like it's not a research institution of open inquiry anymore that you can count on to give you scientific results. So I think a certain, it's difficult to draw the line as to what constitutes what in that, but some of that might be okay. Again, I would really have to see the details to see if it was an acceptable thing. But to say for, you know, to like micromanage departments or...
Yeah, that's the part that worries me.
Some of this stuff is way over the line. And I think the bulk of both true liberals that are left liberals and true liberals that are classical liberals are troubled by these compacts. I think, you know, if you have to say, well, you can only take it as a whole, take it or leave it, I would say no, because I think they're too intrusive on the independence of these universities.
If I were a college leader, I would say no to the compact, but I would do a number of the things.
Yes, many of the things that are suggested are things that would make the universities healthier, better places for scholarship, and would, you know, make the institutions more admirable, and I think would improve the public's perception of the universities and colleges.
So we are, I am at least, very skeptical about the whole enterprise of government funding of higher education generally. And I think that our colleges would be, and universities would be better off if they weren't so dependent.
As I said earlier in my Robert Taft mode,
yeah,
federal aid means federal control.
So, but if you're getting this money, then it doesn't seem unreasonable to have some of these strings. That's the thing here. I was recently speaking to a historian of higher education who was explaining to me the various historical models that have developed. They all developed, of course, out of medieval European monastic practice in one way or another and research. But the German model, distinguished from the English model, the German model emphasized, according to von Humboldt, that there should be state support for universities and absolute autonomy from the state.
We're talking Wilhelm von Humboldt. So there's also an Alexander von Humboldt. The Humboldt current is named after, so that runs near like the Galapagos Islands.
Yeah, I'm on
That's
Wilhelm,
a
I think. Wilhelm
was a classical liberal and wrote a famous book translated into English usually as The Limits of State Action. And it was an inspiration for John Stuart Mill in writing on liberty. But he was also the Prussian Minister of Education.
Right.
So, and this is the role at Graham that I think you're talking about. The problem is, it's very hard to do this. I mean, look at the whole DEI thing. Look at how it's very hard, and this is why I think you are chary of federal aid to higher education. It's very hard to say you can't follow the money with some kind of directives. These are politicians. These are bureaucrats. Politicians want to, you know, ensure their vote. They get more votes in the future. They stay in power. Bureaucrats want to hang on to their jurisdiction, enhance their budgets. These are their incentives that they have, and it's going to lead them to meddle in higher education. Now, you're right that to the extent that this happens, universities should, and many of them have refused the compact, the university should stand up for intellectual autonomy of the universities, but they haven't exactly been following up on their own side. So all this suppression of conservatives, this one-sided faculty, and so forth are not an indication that the principles that they're invoking now are ones that they've been following themselves.
Exactly. And really, essentially, the whole DEI enterprise is a violation of civil rights law, because these institutions using federal money are treating people disparately according to their race. And this seems like it's a pretty minimum expectation. If you're getting a bunch of federal dollars, that you don't break the civil rights laws and that you don't enable and facilitate anti-Semitism. I'm kind of with that.
Well, you know, I hear you, and I put to you that the left liberals say the Trump people are riding a Trojan horse of anti-Semitism into taking over the entire city. Mm. So clearly there is an anti-Semitism problem on campus. And, you know, you see students harassed on the way to class. You see them trapped in libraries.
Exactly.
And the doors being beaten on. Mm-hmm. This is not good.
It's totally unacceptable.
And the people who are doing this should be prosecuted and so forth. On the other hand, you know, you can take a valid point and stretch it into taking control, and that's
right.
what some right. people fear.
Right. Why don't we just skip back to where we started, or kind of near where we started? We were talking about Venezuela earlier.
Right.
And it might be worth mentioning here at the end that there's this interesting phenomenon that the apparently duly elected leader of Venezuela, Machado, was given the Nobel Peace Prize, and she represents an alternative Venezuela. Can you tell us something about her and about that?
Yes. So this is very interesting. So in the past, the Venezuelan opposition to Maduro has been divided. But this woman, who is a classical liberal, she's a libertarian. She, you know, does stuff with the Cato Institute, for example. She acknowledges fully that she wants to privatize state-owned enterprises in Venezuela. She wants to have a free market and so forth. Not saying she's getting rid of the safety net entirely or something like that. She's a moderate classical liberal. But the point is, she thinks of herself as a classical liberal. Her party belongs to the Liberal International, which is a organization of parties, some of them pretty watered down, but at least their historical roots are in the true classical liberal parties. So it's kind of first of all, she probably, almost certainly, she won the election. Her people kept separate tallies for each precinct. I don't know what they call them there, but the equivalent of American precincts. They clearly won. And anyway, Maduro just said, forget it. I'll put out my fake numbers and I'm going to stay in power. She's generally been pretty good. Her side is not engaged in violence against the government. I mean, they have less arms and so forth, but so they're not in a good position to do anything. She has more recently been asking for the United States to overthrow Maduro. I think that's pretty problematic, but it's understandable in her case. And she wielded, not all, I don't want to pretend that all the opposition to Maduro is classical liberal, is libertarian. No, it's not. But she's the leader, and she's managed to work out a modus vivendi with the other parties. And I think it's amazing. And she's generally had a good program. I think it's interesting in Latin America, which wouldn't necessarily have been considered a hotbed of classical liberal activity, Xavier Milei just won a big election, a parliamentary election in Argentina. He way, way exceeded the polling. He did extremely well in the poverty-stricken slums around the city of Buenos Aires. There was like a 9-point, 10-point swing from the previous local election in Buenos Aires province. And it looks like he's going to have sufficient political power to carry forth on something. He's going to have to work with, you know, there are conservative parties that he can work with, that he has been working with. He's going to have to get some cooperation from provincial governors and things like that. But the Peronist Party, which is a sort of left fascist, trade union based, redistributionist, I could go on and on, party.
We get it.
Yeah. They previously had a situation where they could veto if he did something or his party passed something, or if he vetoed something, they could override his veto. They can't do it anymore. So he will have additional capacity to make reforms in the labor area and the tax area and other areas. If you list out all the things he's done since he came to power, which was, he's only been in power like a year, it's a list of, 100 things. It's amazing.
And, it's stunning, yeah.
Certainly, inflation has been brought down from 12 to 2%, which is incredibly important. Now, one of his remaining problems is the money. So
right.
They have this peso. It's very wobbly. He's talked long about dollarization. People in things like the World Bank want him to go with floating exchange rates or something different. They don't want dollarization. Dollarization would probably be a vast improvement. Malahi himself knows all about the gold standard and knows that that would even be more ideal. But anyway, if they could dollarize, they would probably save themselves from this problem with the shaky currency. In any case, in Argentina, it looks much more optimistic than it did 2 weeks ago. And in Venezuela, it looks problematic, partly because somebody might make a misstep.
That's the problem with military action.
And Colombia. I mean, it would not be good to be at war with Colombia and Venezuela.
But it is a good thing that South America has one remarkable leader in authority and another waiting in the wings, Machado,
right,
in Venezuela.
Right.
And I understand that there was recently a vote in Bolivia, turning
not
away from
bad.
The Socialist,
yeah,
Marxist Party there, and there's a pending
vote
in Chile.
Don't have me bring up Ireland, though, which is just had a catastrophic vote for president.
We will save that for another time. Bill, thank you so much for your insights on these things.
Let me throw out one other very bizarre thing. So there's a well-known song by The Who called Pinball Wizard. And it's part of a musical that's playing in the West End in London right now.
Ah.
So one of the points of the song is that deaf, dumb, blind kid sure plays a mean pinball. They've taken out the words deaf, dumb, blind kid.
Really? I remember the song.
Of course. But the thing is, it's amazing that a person that has disabilities could be good at pinball. Okay. So that's part of the power of the song. But the producer who's taken these words out claims, these words have nothing to do with the point of the song or the plot of the musical. This is political correctness run amok.
It really
is. I would like to leave my comments with that bizarre thing.
That is bizarre and revealing. Thank you, Bill. Thank you to all of our friends who've joined us for this conversation. I do want to remind you that you can find additional resources on these and other topics from both Phil Magnus and Bill Evers and others on our website, independent.org. Always worth a visit. And we hope that you join us next time for Independent Outlook. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.